Thank you everyone for coming during a rainy Sunday. It's good to see everyone. For me, it's very meaningful. This is the week of Rav Lichtenstein's Yahrzeit. So I try to spend a little more time thinking about him, learning his Torah, trying to read some of his articles, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully. And so it's important for me. So thank you for coming and giving me the opportunity. What I'd like to present today, or explore today, is obviously, Kvod HaRav, is obviously Rav Lichtenstein's views on humanism. But beyond that, I want to highlight three different elements. Number one, how subtle and nuanced Rav Aaron was as a thinker. He used to speak Friday night between Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv, minimum for an hour and a half. In the summer, we used to make Kiddush at 10:30 at night. My kids, my wife would wait till 10:30. And my wife would ask me after Kiddush, what did Rav Aaron speak about tonight? And I said, he said that Moshe was a good person. And my wife would say, it took him an hour and a half to say that. What is good? What are the dangers of good? Divine good, human good, modern good. Everything was subtle and nuanced, and he taught us that life isn't to be processed in black and white and yes or no. It's a nice... Sometimes people ask me a question, and it's a framework. There's three or four factors. Here's a way to parse it. As you know, that's the authentic... That's life, that's reality. And when you simplify it, you lose some of its depth and some of its resonance. And he taught us to think subtle and nuanced, not over-sophisticated. It's a thin line between over-sophistication and over-analysis, paralysis by analysis. The second thing I'd like to highlight today is, I think it was someone in this shul who once complained to me, maybe 10 years ago. Someone in this shul, not you, Harry. Someone in this shul. Right. It could have been you. Complained to me. It could have been. Why do you always quote Rav Amital? You never quote Rav Lichtenstein. And I thought about that. And I realized that Rav Lichtenstein is unquotable. Why is Rav Aaron unquotable? Because he was never discussing a particular topic. He was always building the entire system. It was very panoramic. We were discussing all of Yiddishkeit and all of religious identity. And there was just a different prism or a different trigger point. So sometimes there was humanism, and sometimes there was Avodas Hashem, and sometimes... But it always sprouted so far beyond. It wasn't periscopic or telescopic. What is this issue, or what is it playing our life? I felt as if he was building an edifice brick by brick. Every time he taught us, he was building an edifice of religious identity layer by layer by layer. And the angle was different sometimes. And obviously, since the angle was different, the flavor and the tone was different. But there wasn't that one money quote. The articles are so far more transcending and surpassing than any one particular topic. So we'll discuss humanism today, but it's really a tour de force about how we view religion and religious identity. The third part, not in order of how I'll unfold it, but my third aim, is to highlight how this affected Rav Lichtenstein in ways beyond what he wrote. So most of the share today, I just want to summarize a very, very complicated article. In the late 60s, Rav Aaron was part of an ethical think tank in called the Rogerson Institute under the auspices of YU. And these aren't speeches, which are hard, or essays, which are even more labyrinthine. These are essentially theses. He wrote these theses about ethics and halacha and modern ideas. And they're almost impossible to read. I mean, it took me three or four runs through. They were just recently published in a book called Values in Halacha. It's very tough sledding. It's highly academic works. He's hunting down obscure academicians and writers from the 50s and 19th century. There's not his classic writers and poets that he quotes. So I, in addition to trying to simplify and organize some of that material, I also want to comment towards the end how I felt, this is my own personal reflections, how I felt being a humanist changed or affected Rav Lichtenstein as a Rebbe and as a Rosh Hashiva. Okay. Rav Lichtenstein's premise for this entire essay, are humanism and religion congruent? Are they synchronous? You'd answer that question, you'd expect a yes or no answer, which Rav Aaron is obviously not going to provide. But if there would be a no answer, there would be an answer, you'd think it'd be no. Because if you trace the history of humanism, even though it began from religious roots in the 15th and 16th century, quickly with the political liberation, the political freedom of the 18th century, and the political and the freedom of thought of the 19th century, not just liberating politics, but liberating human conscience and human mind and human thought, at a certain stage, humanism becomes secular. The advance of man, the needs of man, the secular city, Harvey Cox, maybe that rings a bell in some people's minds, almost the Bible, It would be the equivalent of Noah Harari today, transhumanism. We don't need God anymore. We have a secular city. We have tools. We have technology, the McDouble syndrome in modern incarnation. So you wouldn't think, people say the word humanism, you don't assume it's synonymous with religion. Okay, so I will, of course. And Rav Aaron will as well, of course. That's our starting point. Rav Aaron's not going to give a yes or no answer. He's going to carefully deconstruct humanism, carefully deconstruct the Avodas Hashem religion. He's going to find points of convergence and points of conflict, and that will help us and help me and help human beings find deep religious voices rather than simplistic, yes, no, I'm left, I'm right, I'm a yekim. These labels, they stand in the way of deep and authentic meaning. When we start to parse identity and deconstruct it and say, this is what I do, so these are elements I do support, these are elements I feel are incongruous, then we reach a deeper level of religious identity. So, of course, how do you define humanism? So Rav Aaron just gave a workman's definition. I don't know if this would hold up in any college course, but a system of thought that highly values man, places great value on man, highly respects man. So does Judaism subscribe to that idea? So in order to map this question, Rav Aaron divided it into two sections, and he didn't announce this, but his work divides itself into two sections. And section two further subdivides into two sections. So essentially, there'll be three parts to today's conversation. Part A, part B1, B2. Part A is, does Judaism agree with humanism in how we view the nature of man? The theoretical question, how is man's nature? How is he created? How does Hashem see us? What is Hashem's general expectations of us in a vacuum? Part B is experience. How does humanism affect halachic experience? Not just our view of man and our self-perception, but our religious experience. That second part, religious experience, will further subdivide into a general essay, a general assessment, and can we find within the halachic system certain halachic factors that emerge from humanistic concerns? And this is where Rav Lichtenstein becomes ish halacha. It's very, very eerie that in this essay written in the late 60s, he speaks in ways that are reminiscent of the Rav in ish halacha. And I'm wondering how much of cross-pollination there was, what conversations took place, and you'll see it coming out at you when we get to part B2. So what about the nature of man? Humanism asserts, that man is a grand, exquisite creature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, unlike any other creature, gifted with a Tzelem Elokim, which we define as the entire range of traits which we possess, which animals don't. From freedom of conscience, to free will, to creativity, to cognitive speech, to consciousness, to dreams, to visions, to relationships, to emotions, that entire battery of human faculties that we don't detect too often in the dogs which we live, or the cats. So human beings have Tzelem Elokim, and I want to try to quote some of the sources Rav Aaron quoted, but also bring them into this room, so there's a copious amount of Rav Lichtenstein's quotes himself, quoting Rav Aaron. But Rav Aaron quoted Rabbi Kiva, of course, Sviras Omer, Chavev Adam, Shenivra B'Tselem, Elokim, Chiba Yisera. Not only is man an exclusive creature, but he's also the pinnacle of creation. The world was created to serve him. I'm not sure the Rambam would agree with that, but Rav Lichtenstein always supported, in most cases, the Ramban as opposed to the Rambam. Rav Aaron quoted source number two, Amur Malach HaSharetz Afdei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribbono Shel Olam, you created this beautiful world, stocked with potential, stocked with lavish opportunity, but what worth is there to this world if there is no prince to enjoy all of its opportunities? Lama nivro migdol male kol tov. Source number two, line three. Ve'in lo orchin ma'anai labav. What possible benefit is there for you who created this world if you haven't yet created mankind on the sixth day? In this respect, Rav Aaron believed that humanism and religion overlapped. Are identical. We believe in Tzelem Elokim. We believe that we are a unique creature gifted by Hashem with unique talents, gifts, and faculties. Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. The world is meant to support human experience, of course, to support human experience, as we'll see later, for religious mission. So with regard to the first question, the nature of man, Rav Aaron felt there was overlap with two caveats. And these were important caveats. Number one, Judaism does not assert the unconditional dignity and loftiness of man. As Rav Aaron said, there's an inner antinomy, which I have to look up, but which is an inner dichotomy in man's stature. Namely, he can be lofty if he obeys, succeeds, maximizes his potential. If he fails, then he becomes vulnerable, inferior, degraded. So it's not as if, I'm not sure, not having read that much of secular humanism, but it trumpets man's potential in an unconditional fashion. Whereas we hear the voice of Koheles providing the other view. Havel havelim ha'kol havel. And man's identity or man's profile is a function of his behavior. So, for example, the Medrash, and it's in Parshas Tazria Mitzara Medrash, because in Parshas Tazria Mitzara you have a sequencing between animals, Parshas Shmini, and man, Ishaki Tazria Tazria Mitzara, which in many ways inverts the sequencing of Bereshis, because in Bereshis, if you believe that Ruach Elokim or Acheves Al Pnei Amayim refers to Mashiach and the potential of mankind, so man precedes animals. So in Bereshis, Ruach Elokim or Acheves comes before the description of animals. Whereas in Sefer Vayikra, Parsha Shmini, Machalas Asiros, Seset Tochlu, Seset Lo Tochlu, precedes Tazria Mitzvah. It's a well-known Medrash. The Medrash comments, Im Zacha, source number 3, Omrim Lo, Ata Kidamta, Le Maisi Bereshis. If a person merits, obeys, achieves this potential, so he's first. Im Lo, and if he doesn't, line number 2, Omrim lo zivuv kadamcha, a maggot comes before you, yitrish kadamcha, an insect comes before you, shilshul kadamcha, shilshul doesn't mean a bowel movement, shilshul means something ugly and vulgar. So, whereas humanism asserted this celebration of man, celebration of his potential, celebration of his stature in the universe, Yiddishkeit says he has that potential, but he also has the potential to be vulnerable and to fail and to fall. The second issue in which Yiddishkeit differs is that this lofty stature is not inherent by the very fact that you're a human being, but it is conferred by the Rabbanu Shel Olam. It is endowed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu through selection, and because it's endowed, it carries with it responsibilities and missions and obligations. If it were inherent, that man is inherently superior, inherently surpassing, then there'd be no mission or obligation. I'm just the highest creature. I'm a pinnacle. I'm gifted, and I deserve to luxuriate. But I'm a gifted creature because Hashem chose me. And he endowed me with it. And because of that, it carries responsibility. The ideal that we would refer to in the modern context is godless Adam. Man is so great, such potential, but with great potential comes great responsibility. Rav Lichtenstein saw this divine endowment as the source of man's lofty stature, both in a parak in Tehillim, but more so, and Rav Aaron had a very, very keen literary eye. Rav Aaron wasn't a meta-literary reader of Tanakh the same way that many of the people in Herzog are today, but he was a very keen reader, more of a micro-reader. He read particular texts, particular fragments, paragraphs. He wasn't reading large, whole-scale texts and comparing. It was very infrequent. And he read the liturgy towards the end of Tfilas Ne'ilah. During Tfilas Ne'ilah, of course, the last vidui is not the long Al-Chayt. We swap it out. It's a short Hashanu Bagadu. There's a very soulful preface. So what's the preface to the final vidui of Ne'ilah? Source number 5, Ma Anachnu, Ma Chayenu, Ma Tzidkenu, the futility of man, the vacancy of man, man is void, man is empty, man is pointless. Ko Maaseh Tov, Yimei Chayim Havel Lefanecha, Mosa Adam Min Havei Ma'ayin, Ka'kol Havel. And then we segue immediately into Ata Hivdalta Enosh Merosh. You designated man, Batakireu Lamod Lefanecha. And you acknowledged him, and you embraced him, and you positioned him to stand metaphorically in front of you, in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the traits that reflect the Rabbanu Shel Olam. So it's that shift from Manu Machayenu. We are not inherently lofty, we are just endowed and selected towards loftiness. There Rav Aaron saw in the Tefillah of Ne'ilah, and of course it's latent in Tehillim Paraches, Kier Shemecha, source number 6, Maseyetz Vosecha, Yirech Kochavim Shekananta. When I look at the stars, and I look at the universe, and look at the cosmos, Ma Anashki Tifkedenu. He's nothing, he's meaningless, but Vatachasya Mat Melukim. Yet your Kodesh Baruch Hu elevated his status to a semi-demiurgic level, or almost as if he's godlike, Vatachasya Mat Melukim. So I wanted Rav Aaron's voice to resonate in this year, so let's read source number 7 and 8. And I'll just read a few lines, but obviously these are all the pages from the recent book. Mankind is not having only line 2 rights, but responsibilities. Man's relation to God entails obligations that the energies which might have been channeled toward the advancement of purely human welfare are expended in the service of Hashem. We have divine endowment of loftiness, but that divine endowment carries missions and responsibilities which divert our energies and our interests away from self-indulgence, pleasure, and human prosperity towards the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This relation, source number 8, is initiated through an act of grace. It is Hashem, God, who invests human life with meaning, first by electing man by the act of creation, and then by maintaining community with him. So this is the Rav Lichtenstein agreeing, endorsing the overlap in the way humanistic thought views man and Judaism views man with these two caveats. He concludes this first part of his essay in a very fascinating, I would call it almost irony. He sees in the world of halacha and halachic obligation and religious commitment and ritual responsibility, he sees that as a celebration of man in some ways. What do you mean? I submit my authority, I suppress my own identity, I serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But halacha is based on choice, freedom of choice, choose. And we're the only creatures who have freedom of choice. And therefore, we're the only creatures to whom halachic system is relevant. So in an odd way, halacha celebrates human identity and human loftiness. And this is how he articulates it, source number 9. You can hear Aharon's voice. Those who heard him speak, you'll hear his voice in some of the quick and short moral demands. I call it more. He had a moral velocity to him. You felt as if like he was a speed pitcher and just threw those moral ideas and you felt yourself. So let me just read the piece. The whole of halacha rests upon this vision. It's grounded on one cardinal premise, source 9, human freedom and creativity. Halacha is grounded in human freedom and creativity. Just listen to those words. How many people would see in the halachic experience human freedom and creativity? It trumpets forth in turn one central message, human freedom and creativity. It does not merely posit this as a doctrine, I'm excerpting, it envisions freedom at every level and in every sphere. It makes one persistent demand, choose, decide. As a pervasive legal system, it posits Jewish existence at the plane of maximal consciousness and decision. The Jew is insistently called upon to exercise intelligence, rational will, to act as a subject, rather than a passive object. Of course, the Gavra Chetza dichotomy, which Aharon was so fond of. Be a Gavra, don't be a Chetza. Be active, make decisions, don't be passive and apathetic. So Aharon believed of the assert of the overlap, two caveats. Number one, there's an inner dichotomy. There's a potential of man to rise or fall, and the status is lofty. The lofty status is divinely inspired, divinely endowed. And halacha is a reflection of Judaism's celebration of the dignity of man and the inequality of man. I'm sorry.
When you got in 7, that comment about man feels regarded as obligations to the energy, channel towards the events of purely human hope are extended in the service of God. I'm not sure, is that split between,
Okay, give him some time. He's going to get to that. He's still working on his theory. Anyone who knows Rav Aharon, he's still planting Easter eggs.
Rabbi
Eliezer, what?
Rabbi Eliezer, Tanner Shalom.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. That is Rav Lichtenstein's first portion. Nature of man. What about the experience of man? What about the religious experience? Not how we view ourselves, but our day-to-day Jewish experience. Is it humanistic or not? No surprise. The answer is going to be, of course, subtle and complex, sophisticated. Rav Aharon suggested that you would believe that the more humanistic you are, the less otherworldly you'd be. If you're more humanistic, then you channel resources and efforts towards maximal pleasure, maximal indulgence, not hedonistically, not immorally, but to enjoy life of prosperity and welfare and think less about the other world. So you would assume there to be a cause and effect relationship between a humanistic system and a system that embraces human experience in our world. Rav Aharon suggested that, but in a very cute way, because I never heard him quote this before, in a very cute way, he rejected that linkage. He writes, source number 10, in a sense, of course, line 3, the two problems are related. Insofar as one assumes the majesty and dignity of man, he presumably becomes less prone to otherworldliness. Respect for human personality would naturally lead to concern for satisfying all its needs and for fullest development of the total environment. So you'd think that if you're humanistic, then you should be less concerned with the other world, more grounded in this world. Rav Aharon, source 10, 11 says it's not true. You can liberate the two issues. The two issues are autonomous. It says, take, for example, Rav Yosef Yozel Horowitz, the founder of the Novadic School of Musar, which entertained the most exalted conceptions of man's intrinsic worth, and yet counseled radical forms of asceticism and renunciation. So Rav Aharon, at least in theory, recognizes that how you see man doesn't necessarily translate in how much you center man's experience in human welfare within the priorities of this world. So the questions are separate, right? This is Rav Aaron's classic preface. Is it one question or two questions? Rav Aaron says it's two questions. The nature of man, the experience of man. What about the experience of man? Is it humanistic or not? So Rav Aaron, this is B, part one, itemized three areas of halacha. I don't mean three specific halachas, filims is a masa. Three halachic concepts, which to him reflected the value of humanism in the halachic metaphors, the universe. Number one, Rav Aaron, is a chesed. The fact that the Torah places such a strong emphasis upon chesed, Rav Lichtenstein reflected that the Torah cares about human experience, human welfare, lack of stress, alleviating suffering. If the Torah were completely otherworldly, this was just a passage, and human needs were in no way relevant, why place such a strong emphasis on chesed? So the world of chesed, although we know the world of chesed is multi-tiered, we perform chesed to sculpt ourselves in the image of Hashem. We perform chesed for social reasons. There are many reasons we perform chesed, but at the core of chesed is care and concern and sympathy for the person who suffers. So the Torah, by demanding chesed from us, is accrediting and valuing human experience as significant. Source number 12, this spirit about chesed is rooted in an awareness of the significance of man's temporal needs, physical as well as psychological. That's number one. Number two, the second meta-area in halacha, which Rav Lichtenstein reflected, humanistic tone, was the absolute lack of asceticism and self-deprivation in halacha. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to fast. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to deprive ourselves. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to self-flagellate. That ethos of suffering and self-immolation and self-deprivation is completely absent from the halachic system. As Rav Aaron writes, the emphasis is upon a discipline of choice and direction. So page 54, source 12. Man's basic physiological and psychological drives are healthy. They're channeled and chastened by being integrated into a harmoniously ordered discipline. The basic goal is kedusha, not suppression, but sanctification. And Rav Aaron would always quote this Gemara. It appears several cases. I quoted from Bava Kamma about Belezer HaKapar. You mentioned Belezer before. There's a Belezer HaKapar and a Belezer Menhurkinus. Belezer HaKapar, who claimed that the Korban Chatas of a Nazir, even though the simple reading of the Pasuk is the Korban Chatas is offered as after he fails his Naziris, after he corrupts his Naziris through Tumah, Belezer HaKapar believed that Korban Chatas was really an atonement for the Naziris itself. The Naziris itself, though aspirational and well-intended, upsets the carefully calibrated relationship that Hashem wants in this world between otherworldliness and disengagement and indulgement in physical pleasure. So Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to enjoy this world. Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to partake in this world. He prohibited certain items. By adding to the list of prohibitions, the Nazir is not just extending, but he's disfiguring the halachic system. Abba Blessed HaKapar, source number 14. Matam Elamer V'chipo Elav Meshech Atal Enefesh Shetzir Atzmo Min Hayayin. He's depriving himself, and of course the Rambam editorializes Belezer HaKapar. The Rambam, Milchus Naziros, adopts Belezer HaKapar, right? 90% of the Rambam's legal, but this is one of his editorials. And interestingly enough, it's one of the editorials that doesn't come at the end of a section. Most of the Rambam's moral editorials are at the end of sections. This is in the middle of Milchus Naziros. The Rambam describes the chait of the Nazir as tampering with the delicate balance that Kadosh Baruch Hu created between engagement and disengagement in Kedusha and engagement in our world. Just to show you the dexterity that Rav Aaron displayed when reading Mamari Chazal, so often people will quote one statement of Chazal and present it as if it's the absolute comprehensive truth of all moral values, when there are a dozen other statements, because it's a stereo. The Gemara is a stereo, Shas is a stereo. But also they'll read a Gemara in one specific way without acknowledging there are multiple ways to read the Gemara. Remember, Rav Aaron once spoke to us about a Gemara that says the Talmid Chachamim should not frequent their wives too often, because they'll be like chickens, rather only Friday nights. So many people read that Gemara as a Gemara that denounces sexual pleasure, is not part of our marriages, try to limit it as much as possible, only on a Friday evening, otherwise you're just a chicken. Rav Aaron felt the Gemara could be read differently, that there should be romance and marital interaction. And if it's too frequent, then you empty it of any romance and it feels like you're a chicken. So if you limit the frequency, then you increase and augment the romance. So these Gemaras, all of a sudden, would be prepared to hear the Gemara one way, and then there'd be an entirely different way to read the Gemara. So Rav Yehuda HaNasi, when he dies, and his death was iconic because he was such a major figure, there are certain people who, when they die, like Rav Meir Shapiro, their death becomes a myth and legend. So Rav Yehuda HaNasi was dying, and he lifted his 10 fingers to heaven, He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these 10 fingers never had any pleasure from this world. That sounds like a Pitanas. He was an ascetic. And if you read Tosas, that's how he reads it. Source number 17. Lona Nesia Filo Be'etzpoktana, Damrina Be'medrash. Tosas quotes a puritanical medrash, a Victorian medrash. Ach Adam Ispalo Shiyichnis Tara Latel Kufa, while you're davening to internalize Tara, Ispalo Shalo Yichnis Umadanam Latel Kufa. Also daven that whatever food you ate, whatever pleasure you engage in, should also not become internalized because it's schmutz and it's corrupting and it's contaminating. But if you look at Rashi, Rashi reads Rabbi Danasi a little differently. Rabbi Danasi was not claiming that he had avoided any pleasure. Rabbi Danasi was pulling the Shmuel card. I didn't gain from my office. I didn't take bribes. I didn't take any salary. Rashi writes, if you read Rashi carefully, Lo nenesi b'olam hazeh afilu lefi tarach shiagati. I worked hard. I was a committed leader. I codified Shas. I canonized the Mishnayos. And I didn't take a salary. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I was an honest broker. These Shmuel Moshe, this deathbed confession, they didn't skim any money off the top. And of course, this is more consistent because what does the Gemara in Avodah Zarah say? That Rabbi Danasi was so wealthy that even during the winter, he had summer fruits on his table, him and Antoninus. Doesn't sound like an ascetic to me. What does the Gemara say in Avodah Zarah? Zantoninus v'rebi, shelo pasku me'al shulchanam, lo chazeres v'lo kishus v'lo tznon. If you want to update, I remember when I was growing up, my mom told me we only had pineapple in the summer because they used to airlift pineapple from the Caribbean. So in the summer, we had, now I guess you can get pineapple even during, I remember during the winter, there's no pineapple. So I thought of this Gemara, I thought about my mom's conversation. You can only get pineapple in the summer. So if you didn't know, he had pineapple even in the winter. He had snow and keshes. It doesn't sound like he was such an ascetic. So the second area which humanism comes, peers out at us from behind the curtain, is not just the stress on chesed, but the lack of asceticism. The third area is what we would call kedusha, integration, synthesis between the two worlds. There's a very cute quote. Rav Lichtenstein's three favorite authors, as far as I can tell, the quote, were John Milton, obviously, Matthew Arnold, and John Henry Newman, 18th century. That's what it, yeah. Well, who would you say is it? What?
Johnson?
Okay, interesting. I mean, I know I quoted him. What? Milton. Milton. Anyway, he had a real affinity for these very strongly religious figures who opposed secularizing influences. I don't know if Arnold would qualify as such. But in this essay, he just identifies all these authors I never heard of, and they come popping out of the woodwork. So he finds this author named R.H. Tawney. Anyone? Late 19th century, early 20th century, evidently as capitalism was emerging, great thinkers started to assess its cultural impact, its religious impact, the Ayn Rand genre. Yeah, Ayn Rand is not a particularly religious writer, right? But how does capitalism affect the human imagination? So this author called R.H. Tawney, The Origins of Capitalism and Religion, something of that tune. And Rav Aharon quotes him, but of course, adopts the quote, but that's all. You could hear Rav Aharon when he adopts someone, but he didn't feel that person was moral enough. It was almost as if he victimized the person. He took Tony's statement, he accepted it, but is that all? And it's not Tony's fault. He made a nice moral statement. I remember when we would speak to Rav Aharon, we'd be so nervous. You would hyperventilate, you'd forget your name. You're standing in the presence of awe. So you'd ask him a question, Rebbe, you know, I don't know, do you think... do you think women should learn Gemara, whatever? And let's say the answer, if they're learning Gemara, then this will happen, or so and so. We'd just give a statement. And you'd be so nervous. The only thing you could say, you'd like laugh. It would be a nervous laugh in his presence. And he would then go, you laugh. And then you go on to say, as if you weren't taking his comment seriously. And we always try to tell Rebbe, I'm not laughing at your comment. I'm laughing because I'm so nervous. That's the only peep I can utter. But this story repeated itself again and again. You'd ask him a question, he'd tell you, well, if this happens, then this will happen. You would laugh because you couldn't say anything, and then he would become very, very morally outraged. You laugh. We're not laughing, Rebbe. I'm trying to breathe. I'm trying to get my balance. So Tawney, this author, describes what we would call the integration between the physical world, as ugly as it sometimes is, and the world of spirit. And Tawney says, this is a great phrase, that as squalid and dirty and vulgar as that world sometimes is, it still provides the scaffolding for the spirit. It's a beautiful phrase. Let's read 20. 20 says, source 19, we welcome line two, the gross world of human appetites. The gross world of human appetites as the squalid scaffolding from amid which the life of spirit must rise. So Rav Aaron says, I agree with Tony, but that's all. It's a squalid scaffolding. Halacha does not merely regard the mundane order as squalid scaffolding from which spiritual life may emerge. The mundane is itself a facet of spiritual life, not just an arena, but the very fabric of halachic living. So that was his third example. Chesed, lack of asceticism, and integration and synthesis between the two worlds. So Rav Lichtenstein, all these three modes of halacha, we haven't talked about a halacha per se, but all these three modes of halacha reflected humanistic strains, not just in the theory of man, the stature of man, the profile of man, but what we call the religious experience, halacha, Torah, and mitzvahs. However, Rav Aaron said, there's one major difference. If halacha doesn't demand asceticism, it does demand sacrifice. And sacrifice, as we call it, mitzvos, shift authority from humanity, human beings, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not just authority of will, but authority of conscience. Namely, I have responsibility to act as HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands me, and under certain conditions, I even have to suspend my moral judgment and defer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's moral judgment. So I don't just surrender freedom of action, I surrender freedom of conscience, as Avram did at the Akedah. So let's just read Rav Aaron. Clearly, if the halacha rejects 22 outright asceticism, it has no hesitation about demanding personal sacrifice. Halacha shifts the center of authority from man to the law, to halacha. Man is no longer vested with the power of decision. Human comfort is discarded. And then he writes source number 23, the sacrifice it requires in principle and occasionally in practice is not only natural inclination, but moral judgment. I have to sacrifice not just my desires, but my judgment. As Kierkegaard so clearly perceived, the Akedah involved Avraham's ethical instincts as well as the son. Very nice metaphor. It wasn't just Yitzchak on the Akedah, it was also Avraham's conscience. Avraham's conscience of morality, his moral spirit, was up on the Akedah. He was sacrificing that on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And again, in a very, very dexterous, insightful, subtle read of the Gemara, Rav Aaron indicated several times in Shas, in Halacha, we have a principle called HaTorah Chasa al Mamono Shel Yisrael. The Torah doesn't want us to waste our money. It protects our financial integrity by not demanding overpriced goods and services. Yet, Rav Aaron indicated that all these examples are all examples that are encased in korbanos. All these situations are broader scenarios where we have to pay money for a korban, we have to sacrifice. And within that, there's a slight adjustment, 5% discount, or in Israel, 2% discount. So for example, more of the cases we have Chasa Mamono Shel Yisrael, source number 20. B'chol yom ha'yechosho shel kesef. Every day the coals were taken with a silver pan, whereas in Yom Kippur it was a gold. So why not every day gold? Hatara Chasa Mamono Shel Yisrael. So we have to spend money. We have to spend money and submit our will, decision making, in conscience to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But Hashem gives us a 5% discount. Don't always use gold, use silver. When we purchase the Shtei Lechem, the Gemara Menachah says that you can purchase wheat, not necessarily flour, because flour will be more expensive in the street. So instead of paying $500, you can pay $400. But Chasa al Mamono Shel Yisrael is never a standalone discount. It's a standalone discount within an encasement or framework of sacrifice. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to sacrifice, but he demands sacrifices on human terms. And he recognizes that human terms demand economic feasibility or economic discounts. So to summarize, this is a summary of part B1, or summary of part A and part B1. This is source 24. This is probably the most concise articulation of this entire, I would say, its entire essay. 24, it is almost ludicrous to speak of Judaism as an anthropocentric religion. Judaism is humanistic in its vision of man's worth, its concern for his well-being, and its positive approach to all aspects of his existence. That's where it's humanistic. The view of man, its concern for his welfare, and its positive approach to the world we live in. But it harbors no illusions about man's servile position, a position he occupies not as a punishment for some original sin. It's not like we're fallen, that's why we serve Hashem, that's our inherent nature. And, of course, at a higher level, as the result of his covenantal commitment. We entered a bris with Hashem, and part of entering that covenant with HaKadosh Baruch Hu means we have responsibilities and we submit to the Ribono Shel Olam. So this is Rav Aaron's summary of the nature of man and religious experience seen large, without getting into the nitty-gritty details and the nuts and bolts here. Yeah.
I'm sure
Look, it's hard to know. You're reading the same text I'm reading. I never spoke with him about it, but I never heard any of that tonality from Rav Aaron. Never. And anytime he raised Christian theology, including original sin and its impact upon the status of man, it was a complete another rejection. I can't comment on what his intention in this phrase is, but maybe someone else remembers. That was something which I think was an anathema to Rav Aaron.
But,
okay. Towards the end of his life, Rav Lichtenstein was very cute with ours. Well, these are not mental problems, but boys who had physical disabilities. We had a Dark Ania program. He didn't talk about that a lot, those issues. I think they're more current, I think, in today's world. We speak about it more frequently. We're more sensitive to it. We live in a harder world. It was never part of the agenda. And as far as I can remember, certainly in his speeches, maybe he wrote about it in places I'm not aware of.
Am I correct when he spoke about original sin? He's not talking about the fact that we're bound to some kafara. I always thought what that meant is that Christian theology, part of the sin of man and woman, has to be appropriate. And Halachic perspective is that's not necessarily so. We can, I suppose.
So again, getting back to Bernie's question, what sticks out in my mind is when Rav Aaron would quote the Ovdo L'Shamra, which he saw as responsibility, either halachic or moral, and the Ovdo L'Shamra, Vaitzav Hashem Adam, all precedes Chait. So the concept of Tzivui and Mitzvot and Mitzvah V'Yosa, written large, and the Ovdo L'Shamra is not in response to the Chait Adam and Chava, but precedes it. So that's the premise of my response. So original sin didn't alter that identity. Maybe readjusted some of the level of the region.
I think that's why Rashi says he does.
Right. Nachum Leibowitz. Okay. Let's move to part B2. Okay. B2 is, and this is where Lichtenstein becomes halachic man. Okay, but I've talked about religion conceptually, philosophically. Can I find halachic elements that indicate, that verify the value of humanistic needs? Is it integral and inherent to halacha? As any good Brisker knows, when you want to access broader ideas of philosophy and Jewish identity, you don't just speculate over a cup of coffee, you don't just read philosophy, you engage in the halachic analysis, you atomize, you take concepts and you atomize them into data points. Then when you have data points, you start thinking about what is this data point reflected by the Kodesh Baruch Hu? So that's the entire premise of Ish Halacha, the entire worldview of Soloveitchik. You take concepts, you atomize them, and then you have data points that serve as springboards for the concept of Judaism. So Rav Lichtenstein is not going to let us off the hook just based on disagreeing with R.H. Tawney about whether it's a scaffolding or an arena. So here's where the article shifts into a Shir Klali. The article is about 100 pages. And Rav Lichtenstein identifies six elements of halacha, which he believes reflects humanistic strain. One is pikuach nefesh, which we'll talk about very briefly. One is kavod abrios. One is darchei shalom. One is tsar. And one is hefsed mamon and chasid chak. And he's about to gauge, by questioning halachic application or questioning the concepts behind them, how humanistic these are and how much influence they should play upon the system. But first, he quotes one of his favorite authors, again, to reject it because he agrees with the theory, but he rejects the application. This John Henry Newman. You want to hear a firm statement? Here's a firm statement, firmer than any Haredi would ever say in B'nai Brak. I'll paraphrase it and then we'll read it together. What's a worser fate? That one Avera should be committed, one small Avera, or the other choice is that the entire universe as we know should collapse, introducing universal suffering and misery. What's the worst condition? An apocalypse or the violation of one Avera? John Henry Newman is going to say, the worst fate imaginable is a slight disobedience of Hashem's will, of the divine will. Here's a statement. It's very strident. He writes, source number 25. It's better for the sun and the moon to drop from heaven, an apocalypse, for the earth to fail, for all the many millions who are upon it to die of starvation and extremist agony, as far as temporal affliction goes. That's a better fate then one soul should commit one venial sin, should tell one willful untruth, should steal one poor farthing without excuse. It's better that the entire universe collapse than one I've ever been committing. Savarin says, do we agree with that? Savarin says, of course we agree with it. However, there are internal checks and balances in halacha that account for human needs. So, in theory, you're right. The disobedience of halacha is the worst fate imaginable. But halacha sometimes accommodates human needs and avoids human starvation and avoids human affliction as part of halacha itself. Carl Lumen is establishing two different systems, the will of Hashem and human welfare, and if push comes to shove, Hashem's will should be violated even at the cost of human welfare. If I'm going to say, no, human welfare is going to participate in the halacha system. So when you think halacha is being violated, it's not being violated, it's being fulfilled because of some human need. And that's his disagreement with Cardinal Newman. I agree with him in theory because halacha is so eternal and so inviolate that the worst scenario is its violation. But when halacha cedes to human need, that's not a suspension of halacha, that's a championing of halacha. That's supporting halacha. So, very, very briefly, Rav Aaron talked about Bikuach Nefesh, famous Rambam Bikuach Nefesh. Remember the editorial? This is another mid-Rambam editorial that Bikuach Nefesh demonstrates how much Hashem is compassionate and cares about human life. This is the Rambam source number 26. When you save lives, don't defer to secondhand people, to inferior people, to undereducated people. Who should violate Shabbos? Gedoli Yisrael v'chachmeyem. Shenemar, sheyasa otzim b'chai b'im. I didn't include the entire Rambam, but those who know the Rambam, she'ein mishpatei atara nekama ba'olam, el rachim v'chasid v'shalom ba'olam, it shows that Hashem is compassionate, supports life, embraces life. My own feeling is this is not fair. I'm commenting on Rav Lichtenstein. I don't think pikuach nefesh indicates humanistic interest. You could justify pikuach nefesh based on halacha calculus, like the Gemara and Shabbos. Why should I violate Shabbos? Because violating Shabbos does Yom Mitzvah augments a lifetime of Shabbos. Why should I violate halacha pikuach nefesh? Because I don't care about you. It's not about the human being. I care about halacha. I care about the will of Hashem. I need to save your life so that you'll fulfill more lulav, more matzah, more tara. So I'm not sure that I agree that pikuach nefesh is such a slam dunk for humanistic needs. It can be justified on many other fronts. Rav Aaron included because it's so clear-cut and so mapped and so concrete. That was the starting point. As opposed to Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom, human dignity, and either social bliss or domestic harmony. Darchei Shalom is both. That's much more amorphous in halacha. Bikuach Nefesh is clearly mapped. This is when you mifakeh hasagol, rav v'shmuel, einochem bikuach nefesh achar rov. So it's a clear map, and it's clearly entrenched in the halachic system. The problem with Kavod HaBrios is, on the one hand, it's less compelling, but on the other hand, it's more ubiquitous, right? How many instances of Pikuach Nefesh do we encounter? But we're always encountering human dignity, social harmony, domestic bliss. Yet, the material provided by Shas is very, very limited. Limited in both senses. First of all, we have very few scenarios in which Kavod HaBrios is actually implemented. Basically, the case of personal hygiene, you're allowed to take toilet paper up to the roof, there are stones. Your personal embarrassment, if let's say in certain cases you're wearing a baguette of shtatnez, in certain cases you may be allowed to keep the baguette on until you get home. Consoling a mourner, if the mourner passes through a field that has tumah midrabanan and you're a kohen, you can follow him through that field to help his mourning. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about relocating a dead body into a carmelis. So that's death, personal hygiene, decomposing bodies. We all sense that those are extreme cases. We're more interested in the day-to-day interaction. And I've been invited to my aunt's house for Shabbos, and her kashrus level is my level. So there's a Kavod HaBrios issue, and how should I navigate? How should I navigate the two? But we don't have that many applications. And even the Kavod HaBrios, which is discussing the Gemara in Brachos, there's a range of Rishonim that contracted. It's only Drabanans and maybe Diraisa Shainim before Shema Pasuk. So as opposed to Pikuach Nefesh, where we have a clear warrant to save lives at the cost of a halachic violation, Kavod HaBrios and even Darchei Shalom are much more limited. Darchei Shalom, the only Gemara we have for Darchei Shalom is the Beis Shammai Beis Hillel Machlokas, understood according to the Ritva. Why does Beis Hillel say you can tell a lie? At least the Ritva understands Darchei Shalom. But in the context of truth and falsehood, that may not be violating Midrash Sheker. That may just be recognizing subjective truth, recognizing social niceties that we say, based on the Gemara above Metzia, oh, my host, he was a terrible host, because you don't want people to storm the house. Or like,
because it did have such an expanded halachic framework where the others may be more intuitive but have such a
Correct. Well, talk about the Churas Ramah that he was basing on. But yes, that's exactly his point. He's aware of it. So in order to bolster the value of Kavod HaBriyos and to bolster the value of Pikuach Nefesh, so for example, he quoted, there's one other example of Shalom Bayis, the Gemara in Shabbos. This is not Darchei Shalom, it's Shalom Bayis. But the Gemara says you have to prioritize Ner Shabbos over Ner Chanukah if you don't have enough money, because Shalom Bayis is more important than Ner Chanukah. I was just discussing last night with some alumni of the yeshiva, we had a get-together Matzah Shabbos. This is not to be publicized, but Rav Lichtenstein once told us that when his children were young, so he routinely davened b'yechidus to help his wife get the children to school. For years, he didn't go to Minyan because he wanted to make sure that his wife had... So I think you were there, remember the Fifth Avenue? It was this. We were just shocked to hear, but obviously this can be abused and it should be told very, very discreetly. But, correct. Anyway, to buttress, let's say, Kavod HaBriyos, Rav Aaron quoted the Mordechai. Why do you cover the challah on Shabbos morning? So you cover the challah Friday night because of the Shechvas HaTal, and there's a double layer, and you get double man, but there's no delivery of man Shabbos morning. So no delivery of man, no Shechvas HaTal, no Shechvas HaTal, no need to cover the bread. So Mordechai Yimsachem says, we all know this, but we never stop to think about it. We don't want to embarrass the bread when we're making Kiddush. What does that mean? The bread's not embarrassed. It's an adam. The bread's not going to blush. It's not going to turn red. I hope not. It's bread. The bread's not going to blush if it's open. Rav Aaron saw this as a Kodesh Baruch Hu conditioning us to the value of Kavod HaBriyos. So that if we're careful not to humiliate the bread, then it will bleed over into our relations. Or as the Medrash says about the Avanim, that you shouldn't, L'tanif Avanim, source number 30, Ma'am Avadim She'em Bohem Das, Lo L'Rav V'lo L'Tova, you shouldn't run up the altar on the Kevesh and have your bottom exposed. We're going to have a long frock and a ramp, not stairs. Again, so the stones wouldn't be embarrassed by seeing concealed parts of the body. Rav Aaron saw this as a reinforcement of Kavod HaBriyos by demanding it even towards inanimate objects. And there's an interesting Rashi. Rashi actually quotes a Makar for Kavod HaBriyos. The Gemara in Shabbos doesn't quote any Makar, the Brachas for Kavod HaBriyos. There's a Rashi in Shabbos that believes that the dispensation not to pick up a lost item, if it's beneath your dignity, if you're an older person, it'll be undignified. If you're a weak person, it'll be undignified, which we think is an internal exception to Hashavas Aveda. Rashi saw as a, it's based on the flow of the Gemara and Brachos, Rashi saw as a global principle of Kavod HaBriyos. So again, the fact that Rashi paid so much attention to Kavod HaBriyos, actually locating a Makar, source number 31, Shadocha lota say gadol kavod habriyos. Shadocha lota say dechsev v'salamta mehem prat lezakein v'enol fichvodo hachinam itoltam. So Rav Aaron tried to reinforce, like you said, kavod habriyos, darchei shalom, tzar. I'm not going to get into all the details of tzar and shas adchak, but this was Rav Aaron trying to fight hard and fast halachic reflections of humanism, so that halacha is suspended not by some external force, to the great horror of John Newman, but by an internal trigger within halacha. So halacha is never violated. I remember, just on a personal level, when I thought about Rav Aaron, I hadn't read this article, but this voice was so prominent when I was a rabbi in Hesk in 2005, 2006, and a lot of these young men and women, especially just coming back from Eretz Yisrael, they were very uncomfortable knowing they'd have to get into a car on Shabbos and knowing they'd have to tighten parts of a wheelchair or apply medicine and creams. And I tried to walk them through the halachic process as best I can. But I remember the first Shabbos, I made an announcement. This summer, we will never surrender halacha. This summer, we will celebrate halacha. And sometimes celebrating halacha means following this line in the Shulchan Aruch. And sometimes celebrating halacha means suspending this line in the Shulchan Aruch for another line. I have to give them that security because they were very nervous, very neurotic. I'm going to get into a car. I'm going to put cream on my camper. So halacha is never suspended. There are internal checks and balances that allow for humanistic needs. With this, I'll conclude, and then I'll just issue a few comments, personal comments. This entire essay was based on a fascinating and controversial Tshuvas HaRambam. And in the new book, they included the tshuva with an English translation. There was a situation the Ramah faced where a woman, who I think her father had passed away, but the brothers and the mother had accumulated a dowry, so the wedding was happening. At some point, they pulled out the dowry last minute, and the wedding was canceled, and then you had this lonely woman, unattended woman, facing marriageless list. No one's going to marry her. And somehow, Erev Shabbos, 2 minutes before Shabbos, someone decided to sponsor her dowry. And now it's Shabbos. But if they wait till after Shabbos for the Kiddushin, maybe they'll change their mind. Now, it's a Mefurish Mishnah in Beit that you can't marry a woman. Emekachin. Lamavav. You can't marry a woman in Shabbos. It's Usser. And basically, the Ramah turns all sorts of halachic calisthenics and somersaults. Divimater. So he has the halachic data, every possible Rabbeinu Tam, maybe Shitas Rashi, he goes through, but you can tell it's very, very transparent. And then he starts talking about Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom, and this poor woman will be completely unmarriageable because no one will support her. And it was a very controversial Ramah. Ramah actually defends himself in the tshuva because he's aware that he's exposing himself to a lot of controversy and a lot of disagreement. But Rav Aaron quoted from the Ramah's tshuva, again with intellectual honesty, but he quoted from the Ramah's tshuva as an example that he thought, and this is an important line, wasn't being followed carefully enough. Namely, he felt that poskim were a little bit too wary to flex Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom to find halachic dispensations. He understood the reason, because it's uncontrollable. If once you admit Darchei Shalom and Kavod HaBrios, all of halacha could collapse. I don't want to keep the halacha because it makes me feel challenged, because I'm tired. Kavod HaBrios. Kavod HaBrios, I don't want to eat matzah. Kavod HaBrios, I don't want to keep dinei nida. So he recognizes the internal fear of expanding the influence of Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom, but he also laments that people are under-applying it, and the under-application of Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom can lead to a concern, not just of halachic calculus, but how people view religion. They view it as imposing and burdensome rather than humanistic and compassionate. And that's the last quote he writes. Consequently, source 734, the failure to invoke these dispensations in any but the most extreme cases, not applying Kavod HaBrios and Darchei Shalom, cannot but erode their position, and popular awareness is, of that position as central values within the Torah halachic order. So he's concerned that Chachamim is rooted there being too firm for their own good. They're not taking these factors into account in their psaques, but he understands that he's not excoriating them, but he understands why there's a hesitancy and awareness. This is a three-part essay. It's about 100 pages. It took me four times to read it. This is very tough sledding. Nature of man, religious experience in general, chesed, asceticism, and then particular halachic data points that indicate the Torah's concern for human welfare. I just want to spend really 5 minutes on how I felt or of Lichtenstein's humanistic tendencies affected him as a Rosh Yeshiva, him as a Rebbe, and him as a person. Number one, I felt, and this I'm sure people would disagree, and there's a conference taking place beneath us, I'm sure many people would disagree there, I wouldn't call Rav Lichtenstein Torah Ramada in the same way that I refer to Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, the flavor is, he's comparing these large systems of human thought, of philosophy, of religious orientation, and noting their differences, noting their overlaps, gleaning deeper understandings, Kant and Judaism, Socrates and Judaism, Hegel and Judaism, crisis theology, Otto, these large systems that have been assembled about how to view our world and how to view our religion, how to view God, comparing them to our view and reaching what he would call a synthesis, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. I'm sure people, this, I never had that feeling, at least in the oral shiurim, that Rav Lichtenstein was embarking on this comparative religion of large systems. He was a deeply religious person. He was also a deeply humanistic person. He deeply, deeply believed in human beings. And if a human being who he respected all human beings, have something wise to say that would help him be a better Oved Hashem, he wanted to read it. But it was more sporadic than it was systemic. I remember when his father was in yeshiva, I think we were there together, and his father was blind and senile, and he gave a shiur whether his father could have an aliyah. We all knew what the maskana would be. And then at some point, maybe in the shiur, afterwards he quoted Samson Agonistes, a poem by John Milton, who was blind, in jail, writing about Shimshon, in jail being blind. And he said, it's not that I value Milton more than Rav Kahana. It's Rav Kahana had more important things to do, who's detailing halacha. But if I want to climb into the mind space of my blind father, I want to read about a blind poet describing a blind prophet in jail, because I want to. Rav Aaron once told us that reading literature is a hechsher mitzvah for ben adam lachavera. Because the more you read, the more you understand human relationships, human interactions, human emotions, human needs, and the more adept you are at interacting with other human beings and being compassionate. So the feel that I got from Rav Lichtenstein, I would describe it as someone that's always standing in the base of Mikdash, but looking out and respecting people and loving people and respecting important comments that he thought could enrich. And I have a proof for this. I have a proof, and I think it's a pretty good rye. Okay, it was a Friday night in Yeshiva, 1995-1996. Rav Aaron was speaking, Bernie, about the fall of man, and everyone was fashlafen because it was long, it was tedious, nothing about Rav Aaron was easy. Everyone's fashlafen in the front row, and all of a sudden in the middle, he screams in English, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Like 30 heads shot up. Then he just quoted Mother Goose rhyme. And as the shiur unfolded, it became apparent that it's not just a Mother Goose rhyme, but it's a metaphor for the fall of man. That all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't repair Adam Arisha. And after the lecture, all the Israelis came over, Misa Humpty Dumpty, Achron Arisha, they want to. Now, I ask you the following open-ended question. Could anyone in their wildest imagination imagine Rabbi Soloveitcher quoting Humpty Dumpty? That wasn't his space. Rav Aaron quoted Milton and Newman and Humpty Dumpty and Newt Rockne and sports figures and whoever he felt had something of import to say that was relevant to his growth as a person, and by extension, his growth as an Oved Hashem, because to me, that was Rav Aaron's magic. He expanded the definition of what it is to be a human being, and he tried to perfect every component of his human identity and serve Hashem that way. I think he expanded I call it the expansion of the religious vocabulary. Religion is not just Torah and Tefillah and Musar and Chesed, but what does it mean to be a human? How can I perfect every element of being human? And then by being the best human I could be the best Oved Hashem if it's all oriented towards Rabbeinu Shalom. It was a very different feel. My second raya is, I never heard Rav Aaron, I heard him once on a recording, but I never personally heard him say it. I think he avoided the word. He never, ever used the word Lahavdil. I never heard him say, this is a conversation about the Mesillas Yesharim and the Gemara, Lahavdil, Cardinal Newman. I don't think he felt that Cardinal Newman was a Lahavdil. He was bringing Cardinal Newman's wisdom into his religious world. There was no need to create a parochas. He wasn't creating a comparison of systems. He just deeply believed in human beings. Number two, and this is obvious enough time to elaborate, the respect he showed to Gentiles, to non-Jews, who also possessed Tzelem Elokim, were also human beings, which was very difficult, which was very challenging, especially in the West Bank, as it is today, of the 80s. Remember the very controversial debate between him and Rav Dov Lior of Hebron, and Rav Dov Lior came out with this comment, which made Rav Aaron's hair stand on end. It's better that many Palestinians lose their life than the fingernail of one Israeli soldier be scratched. And Rav Aaron was morally indignant. It's better that innocent people lose their lives than an Israeli soldier scratch his fingernail. The value, and he published an article in one of the forums and Chabad Vadim should have been selling one of the newspapers. And that's, I think, what has continued to expose him of these arch claims of being a liberal, of being a Gentile lover. Tzelem Elokim, I think it's a very current issue. I think in both Jewish communities, both in America and Israel, for different reasons, people are mistaking frumkeit and religious zeal and piety with xenophobia and racism and disrespect of other people. We're shifting into a new generation. Obviously, it's a different world, and it's hard for people to update it. Number three, and there are only four. Number three is, I think he shifted to greater or larger degrees of success, but certainly for his Talmidim. I don't know how much this has infiltrated the Israeli society. Israeli religious society is predicated on collectivism. Why? Because it's predicated on Rav Kook. Rav Kook had a collective view of identity. You're part of something larger, a larger cosmological process, a larger people, Knesset Yisrael. The world is moving towards a greater state. The world is becoming aligned with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. You're part of that system. It stems from Hasidus, it stems from Kabbalah. The second you entertain worlds larger than yourself, you de-individualize human experience. You're part of a broader world, a broader Knesset Yisrael. And Rav Aaron worked hard to create individualism within, with Soloveitchik individualism and things. So I'll just give you one example just to highlight the point. It's obviously a peripheral issue, but just it's just a stark highlight. Rav Aaron believed that calculations of pikuach nefesh should influence political policy. So in theory, if peace would save lives, then pikuach nefesh would dictate that we have to try to arrange peace. And Rav Gorin disagreed. Why? Because we think of our presence in Eretz Yisrael collectively, and Pikuach Nefesh doesn't apply collectively. Collectively, we have to go to war, and war people die, so Pikuach Nefesh is out the window. So do you apply Pikuach Nefesh to political decisions in Israel? That cuts right along the border of, are you collectivists or individuals? Obviously, that's an extreme issue. It's not going to affect our day-to-day. But on a day-to-day level, how do you see yourself? And I do feel that in Eretz Yisrael, someone that lived here, moved to Eretz Yisrael, there's a lot of collectivism and personal identity is lost, personal expression is lost. And here there's not enough collectivism, there's more individualism. I remember we once asked Rav Aaron, it's such an interesting question. It was at a tesh and we were all young and we were a little bit chutzpahdik. We didn't mean it to be chutzpahdik, but at least in the 80s, there were a high number of overseas students or Israeli Talmidim that came from overseas homes who were the top boys in yeshiva. They were the boys who were learning the best and at the top shiurim. We said, Rebbe, is it true that the overseas Talmidim and the Israelis who come from American homes tend to be like, you never asked that question today. It's an unfair question. It's judgmental. We're 18 years old. That's what we saw. And Rav Aaron said he believes that it's based on the greater stress on individualism in America and at least in American culture that leads to ambition and aspiration and personal growth, whereas collectivism can sometimes level and create an equalizing effect. I'm no different than anyone else. I'm no better. And I see this in my kids. I see it in their social lives. It's a completely different ethos. And Rav Aaron tried to restore that balance between the individual, Tzelem Elokim, the human being, created divine, created exquisite, rather than being lost in the collectivism. The fourth is as follows. The Gemara says in Erevin, the Baskel comes out and awards Hillel as the final arbiter of Psak. Why? Because they were kind, because they were compassionate, because they deferred to Shammai. That's an odd Gemara. We're establishing halachic authority for eternity. You want to give Hillel an award for morality, that's one thing. But don't decide halachic calculus based on who's a more moral individual. Why is Hillel awarded with halachic arbitration? The answer, I believe, is because Torah at its core is compassionate. Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu at its core is Melech HaRachamim. That's why Torah is called Rahmana. The more compassionate you are, the deeper you understand the wisdoms of Torah. It's not a moral award. Beis Hillel, because they were compassionate, had access to deeper wisdoms of Torah, because Torah at its core is Chesed. Tchilaso Chesed, Besofo Chesed. And I think that was Rav Aaron. If I had to describe one or two monikers, one or two traits of Rav Aaron, he shifted the profile, the Rav Shir. You didn't know the answer. You got screamed at. You got cursed out. You got thrown out of a Chaim Soloveitchik Shir. It was the old Lithuanian style. And Rav Aaron was a kind, compassionate, caring. He didn't exude it because he wasn't charismatic and we were all afraid of him and he was shy. When you got to know him, the lasting memory of who he was just the kindest person I will ever meet. Kind, genteel, considerate, dignified, caring about men, caring. Story's going up, it's too late to describe the stories. And I think that led to the knowledge of Torah. I thought also about Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asks all his Talmidim, what's the most important trait? Isha tova, shachin tov, ayin tova. What does Rabbi Elazar ben Arach say? Leif tov. Okay, the next day, Yochanan ben Zakkai handed out nicknames to his Talmidim. Anyone remember what was the nickname for Elazar ben Arach? Mayan HaMiskaber. So I always say, what's the relation between Mayan HaMiskaber and Leif Tov? The answer is, how do you become a Mayan HaMiskaber? Because you start off as a small stream, but you get fed by other streams, and you become a raging river. That's literally a Mayan HaMiskaber. You're an underground stream. You develop strength because other rivulets feed you, and you become a large river. In order to allow other rivulets to feed you, you have to have a Leif Tov. You have to respect other people, respect their ideas, and embrace their ideas, and learn from their ideas. So because he was a Leif Tov, he was able to generate into a Mayan HaMiskaber. And looking back on Rav Aaron, if you want to listen, Rabbi Rosenzweig gave a hesped in Gush, about 30, during the Shloshim. It was in Hebrew. It's on Yud Torah. There are tones of that in his hesped. We talked about how Rav Lichtenstein shifted the environment, the classroom environment for Rabbi Soloveitchik's harsh expectations and demands. It was a more, we were terrified, but he tried to make it easy for us. He tried to be kind to us. It's not a din in the gavra, it's a din in the chef, and you just had to say the word chef. So obviously it wasn't that simplistic, but he was trying to help us feel better about ourselves. He felt Rabbi Rosenzweig that Rav Aaron did a great chesed and piling through all these from the Rav gave shiur in a Gemara, Rashi, Tosas, Rambam, and Ran. And Rav Aaron all of a sudden read all these svarim, Ravyas and Ravans and Itters and Orzeruas and Kolbos, and he literally, and this was before Bar Ilan, we could just find the word, and he had read all of it and he just would put them on the Makaris. He paved this path through this newfound world of svarim. And the work he must have invested, the amount of prodigious work, reading through these texts that, quite frankly, few before him had read through. I remember Rav Brin once told me, this all end, that he went to the Mir, one of the Rana and Yeshiva went to the Mir for a summer's mind. And everyone in the Mir was a buzz because they were learning part of the Shema, And somehow, wherever the Rosh Hashiva was, I forget who Shira, they were in Russia or yeah, whoever it was, went to the Shira and Rav Nachum maybe, and he gave him a Ravon and Bari Veshema. And everyone's, who is this Ravon? And they looked him up, they're so excited. We heard that Ravon every year. Like every year, we knew that Ravon and Bari Veshema. It was the first Makar on Mar Makomos. Everyone knew that Ravon, who was our best friend, and many, many other Ravons. It's not superior, it's just Rav Lichtenstein opened this world of Torah and worked so hard and provided pathways to us. And I think it wasn't just helping in Torah Mado, or I think it was his identity in Torah. He was just a compassionate, kind person. And I think about him a lot in the same way I think about Hillel. Didn't show, because you had to get to know him, because you were really frightened in his presence. But you got to know who was that person. Anyway, thank you. Have a good day, everyone. Neshama should have an aliyah.
Just disagree with you one step on this comment in terms of